ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. In Paris, in 1968, hippies almost overthrew the government. 68 was the year of the Prague Spring and anti-Vietnam protests across America. These uprisings everywhere in the 60s faded away, except in India, where communists, inspired by Chairman Mao, took control of a significant swathe of territory, only surrendering it this year. Later, how the Modi government finally broke the Maoists. But first, to Canberra, to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent of SBS. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David.
Now, what's going on here with defence? The government is taking charge, is it, of a huge whack of the defence budget. Now, why?
Well, this has been an ongoing discussion between the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, Pat Conroy, who is the Defence Industry Minister. They've flagged that they're looking across defence to try and work out how to deal with the massive cost blowouts that we're so used to hearing about in defence procurement and try to streamline some of these processes because there is an increasing budget at stake here. And the minister has been, I think, frustrated for some time about how some of these defence projects have unfolded and wanted to have more control and more of a say in how things are being done. So helpfully, he and Pat Conroy have announced today this plan to bring together a number of different procurement and capability organisations or groups, as they're called, to deal with things like new purchases, sort of missiles, airborne drones, all kinds of things that defence is now trying to bring to life to protect the nation, and wanting to put them into eventually an agency that can directly engage with him as minister, as opposed to being underneath the Secretary of the Defence Department. Now, this agency will speak to both the Defence Department and the government, but the government will have much more direct say over what is expected to be about 40% of the defence budget. When you think about what's happening in the next decade, David, it's now around $56 billion. By 2034, this is $100 billion. So 40% of that is a pretty significant whack that the government is going to have more direct control over.
But Anna, the soldiers can't be happy with this direct government supervision of such a fundamental defence process, buying weapons.
I think there is certainly some early frustration, but there's also a sense from those who have been watching these areas closely, analysts in this space, that something did need to change about how these processes were unfolding because of the major cost blowouts. And in a way, it does force the government to be more directly accountable. But I think not only will there be that kind of worry within military circles about what this might mean from a control point of view, but it's also not the only big change that is on the horizon for defence. In the next couple of weeks, we're also expecting to see a defence real estate document be released, which will recommend future decisions around some of the big military assets across the country that might be on pretty prime land for housing development. And this is another issue within defence at the moment. What is going to happen with the decision-making over some of those really spectacular locations that are very much seen as the heart of Australia's defence force, but might also be wanted by the government to make good on their proposals to build significant, you know, million houses. That's part of their election promise too. So there are a number of fronts that the defence minister is going to be working on to try and find common ground with the military, and at the same time to make these tough decisions.
It's been a week of weddings and prospective weddings in Canberra, hasn't it? I mean, obviously the Prime Minister getting married, in his garden, touching, simple ceremony. But the other is the looming union between Pauline Hanson and her suitor. They sat down, as you saw, and had a few steaks cooked on a sandwich press. It was a beautiful, touching scene. But how do you rate the chances of the marriage of Barnaby Joyce and Pauline Hanson?
Well, I can't believe we're skipping over the Prime Minister's wedding to Jodie Hayden so quickly.
Oh, well, look, let's go back there. I just thought it was
the Prime Minister's official residence gardens, where he apparently DJed and had a two-tiered cake. But no, we will move on to matters of political
importance. And Mike Bowers, photographer, had an exclusive of a lifetime.
Well, you know, I also had the exclusive over the fence, where you couldn't see a thing.
You climbed a fence, you poor
thing. Everyone had their vantage point. No, I didn't climb any fences. I stood next to a fence line, and we saw nothing but greenery. However, on to the more sort of consequential union to the looming state of the Parliament.
The looming union, making Pauline Hanson an honest woman. It's just an intriguing prospect.
Well, I think it's not something to make light of in many ways. This is a really serious political movement that Barnaby Joyce truly believes is happening in Australia. It sort of reflects some of the things that are happening across the world, from Donald Trump as US president to Nigel Farage in the UK. And we can go into sort of the details of how the different political systems operate and how they don't necessarily match up. But there is a view from someone who has been in politics for a very long time and prides himself as someone who is somewhat tapped into and connected with a particular cohort in the broader electorate, who has genuinely come to the view that the One Nation brand aligns with what Barnaby Joyce wants to do with his political career and gives him more of an opportunity to be at the front of a press conference, not on the back bench and not invited to the press conference, which is, I think, what he's facing at the moment. So it is a big deal. And as someone who grew up in the seat of New England and who's still got a lot of friends and family there, my understanding is that One Nation is growing in support and is growing in its prominence in some parts of regional New South Wales. And there is a lot of interest in what's going to happen as a result of that.
Does Joyce see the possibility of One Nation becoming a coalition partner?
I don't genuinely know what's going on in his head, but I do think that he sees this movement as aligning with something that's happening in the broader community.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at what he's prepared to do and how far he's been prepared to go with this has obviously been months and months in the making. The map of Australia shaped stakes. It was all very organised, and it's all about sending messages and capturing attention. I think our office, you know, like many across the building, was following it all blow by blow. But then there was this extraordinary moment as Barnaby Joyce was working to leave the Nationals and move potentially to One Nation as early as last week, where he was confronted by the reality of Pauline Hanson's burqa stunt in the Senate. And some of his colleagues really do think that has given him some pause to take a moment before he aligns himself directly with Pauline Hanson, because what happened in the Senate has really shocked a lot of people in the Parliament. Not that Pauline Hanson has done this a second time, but that Barnaby Joyce, who is not seen as sort of fringe in some of his politics at least, would want to completely align himself with a political party that does seem a little bit at odds with what he's stood for in the past.
Because he has a decent record on asylum seekers. He was a great supporter, wasn't he, of the Bilawila family?
The Muruguppins. He was, and he went against Peter Dutton and he spoke up on their behalf. Just one example isn't enough to kind of suggest that someone has sort of a long-term ambition in a particular frame, but I think Barnaby Joyce has shown on a fairly regular basis that he's been willing to advocate for new migrants to Australia, and he actually comes with an electorate that has a really big migrant population in New England. So on a local level, he has shown himself to be someone who is quite sympathetic to the idea of Australia being a multicultural place and an accepting place, and not a place to sow sort of the deepest of divisions. And if you want an idea of just how popular or intriguing and compelling the Pauline Hanson stunt was in the Senate last week, I'm not saying popular in terms of people applauding it, but just in terms of people being interested in what happened, the SBS TikTok that was posted online, which had some initial information and then some reaction, it's ticking up over 35 million views at this point in time. Perhaps that says something to the algorithm on these platforms, but it also, I think, says something about the fact that, you know, these kinds of crafted events that can be put up by some of these political parties can have huge traction across the world.
Emma, just on the Nationals still, I was intrigued by the anthem that David Littleproud sang to the splendours of land clearing and the wonderful way in which farmers no longer illegally clear land. That's still, is it, a big issue for farmers in Australia and for the Nationals, the kind of right to clear land?
There is a lot of conjecture over this, and there are a lot of different viewpoints about what is and isn't appropriate on the land clearing front. I mean, what happened with the environment protection changes that Labor and the Greens have backed in, you know, when you get down to the specifics of what's in the legislation that's now been agreed to, so it stops vegetation being cleared from within 50 metres of the Great Barrier Reef catchment. And anywhere across Australia that hasn't been cleared for 15 years, it stops land clearing on some level there as well. And we've had not only, you know, the Environmental Defenders Office, for example, call Australia a global deforestation hotspot, but also, you know, more hard-headed economic types who've been looking at this, like Ken Henry, also saying irresponsible land clearing is a major issue in the country. However, within the world of national supporters and within the farming community, not only is there a diversity of views, but there's also a real pushback against this sense that farmers shouldn't have the right to ensure that their land can be used for agriculture, for food and fibre, that there shouldn't be an ability to make way for agricultural development. And the other issue that has
really... No matter what.
Well, there are many farmers who follow all the rules, and there are also farmers who have decided to become carbon farming front runners, and they do genuinely have properties that they don't work or they don't, you know, use for agricultural purposes. So there are different sides of this coin, but there's also the reality that for some farming communities and from some people that I've sort of spoken to on this, they say, so the government won't allow us to clear our land, but the government does want big renewable industrial level projects to come into regional areas and lock up agricultural land. And that's been a bit of a lightning rod for some people around their frustration with seeing the government as hypocritical on some of these issues. They're not seeing it from the sort of protection of nature point of view as much as the government says, you know, that renewables can be a reason to lock up land, but that we can't do it the same thing in terms of putting out our view that certain land should be used for agriculture. It is a tough area. The Nationals know it. They know that there's a lot of support out there. And, you know, when you look at some of the commentary in the wake of this deal, for example, from the Australian Forest Products Association, they gave evidence to the inquiry. They, you know, I would say have a lot to do with the National Party lobbying wise. They are adamant that every harvested tree is replaced. But you and I both know that it's not the same thing to fell, you know, a 20-year-old tree and plant a new one. Like that's the troubling reality for sort of the protection of nature here.
Now, Anna, very briefly, two ceremonial questions of importance. Firstly, Malcolm Turnbull's portrait. What do we think of that?
Well, I was interested to see who showed up to see the unveiling. It's a very big deal when a portrait is unveiled at Parliament House, and there's a lot of speeches beforehand. They really build the anticipation because we've had two recently, two unveilings. And I think that the audience for the painting was interesting, but then the unveiling of it, for me, it was, you know, deliberately sparse and deliberately I think, designed to pop off those really dark wooden walls of the building. Many people have made different things about the hand gestures.
And, well, they're empty. I mean, his hands are empty.
Or you might say it's an outstretched, you know, approach to say, walk with me.
Now, look, the clock is
the
about
artistic direction.
The clock is about to knock us off very quickly indeed. The state funeral for Richo, still going ahead?
As far as I'm aware, it is happening next week. Power broker, caught up in scandal, courted scandal, not universally admired. And within the Labor Party, there is some concern about this. But at the same time, the Prime Minister has called him a hero, a Labor legend. This is absolutely going ahead.
Buried with honours. Thank you, Anna Henderson. And note, this is Anna's last appearance for the year, so we will look forward to welcoming you back in 2026.
Thank you, David. Anytime.
Anna, thanks. I've been talking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent at SBS. Coming up, the Maoists of India finally bite the dust. A 50-year conflict in India has come to an end with the surrender of the Maoists, who at their height controlled a vast tract of the country, from near the Himalayas down to the centre of India itself. The capitulation of the Maoists over the last year means more than an end of decades of violence. It promises to unlock immense wealth in India. To discuss the rise and fall of the Maoists, we're joined by Rahul Pandita, a distinguished New Delhi-based journalist who has reported the Maoist insurgency for many years and wrote the book Hello Bastar, The Untold Story of India's Maoist Movement. Rahul, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Rahul, where did the Maoists come from? There had always been a communist party in India.
Well, the history of the Maoist movement in India will have to be divided into two chapters. So the first insurrection began in India in the 60s. It was led by erstwhile members of India's mainstream Communist Party, who got disillusioned with their organization and they felt that the Communist Party had moved away from the concerns and welfare of the poor and the marginalized they claimed to represent. And it inspired a lot of young students and other young people in those days. And many young students from India's most elite institutions left their education, left their college and universities and joined the movement. But the movement came to naught in a matter of just a few years because beyond the concept of class annihilation, which meant that many youngsters would just roam around with a knife or a country-made, very crude pistol and kill a lone policeman standing somewhere on a street in Calcutta in East India. It did not achieve much. And by the early 70s, the movement was contained.
But then comes the second stage. Tell us about the second stage of the movement.
The second stage began somewhere right after the first stage was over. It started in a completely different place, in southern India, in the state of Andhra Pradesh, where a former associate of Charu Majumdar, who was the main leader of the Maoist insurrection 1.0, he made some changes. And from there, the Maoists grew in strength till we reached a point in the mid-2000s. When two communist parties, Maoist parties, came together and formed an umbrella party called the CPM Maoist, which is Communist Party of India Maoist. So their strength was in many ways doubled. And by this time, they had established what is called a rear base in central India, which is essentially home to India's indigenous people. We're talking about a thick Amazon-like dense jungle where there's an absolute vacuum left by the Indian state. And that vacuum was essentially filled over years by the Maoist guerrillas. And then the state went after them. But, in the initial years, it could not achieve much because the Maoists had the sympathy of the indigenous people and the other marginalized communities living in this area. But from 2010 onwards, a lot of development has happened in these places. It has worked a lot on road mobility, mobile networks, connection, etc. And now, under the BJP government, in the last couple of years, there's been absolute onslaught where the Union Home Minister has said that, you know, we have to bring Maoism to its knees. And something dramatic has happened in the last couple of years, in the sense that suddenly a movement which the erstwhile Prime Minister, Mr. Manmohan Singh, called India's biggest internal security threat, as recently as in 2009, is almost over in a matter of a couple of years.
Now, Rahul, let's go back a bit, because I want to talk about the Maoists at their height. What were the Maoist strategies? Were they violent? How did they actually operate?
So this communist leader who sort of started Maoist 2.0, a man called Kondapalli Sidaramaiah, he's popularly known as KS in Maoist circles, he made two changes. The first change was establishing this rear base, which I talked about. The other change was the creation of overground organizations. So through these overground organizations, which attracted a lot of youth in Andhra Pradesh and many states, so these students basically then became Maoists between 75 and 80. And these are the ideologically driven men and women who then entered this forest area, which I'm talking about, which the Maoists call Dandakaranya in central and eastern India. It's a long contiguous area, if I may say so, which it's like an arc from Nepal's border with India till southern part of India.
Sort of cutting India, almost cutting India in two.
Well, you know, there was a time when they had influence over almost one-fourth of India's territory, about 120 to 150 districts out of odd 660 districts in India. So what they did is they started training a lot of indigenous people here, and they created this guerrilla base in many, many areas. And then they were, in the initial years, they were trained by a ragtag group which owed its allegiance to the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, the LTTE. So the biggest strength of LTTE was in laying improvised explosive device, which is a training which was imparted very well to the Maoist guerrillas. And they did a lot of damage to security forces who would go after them. There's this one incident which happens in 2010 in which 75 policemen are killed, which is the biggest number of casualty in any sort of insurgency in post-1947 India. So a big challenge.
Tell us about your contact with the Maoists and how you came to have that contact and what you discovered when you came to know them and talk to them.
Well, you know, I had a personal history of dealing with insurgency in India. I come from the northern state of Jammu and Kashmir, which is the only Muslim-majority state in otherwise Hindu-majority India. And in 1990, my community, the Kashmiri Hindus, were driven out of the state by Islamist extremists. And it strangely did not get the kind of traction or the press media coverage or the coverage of the international community the way it should have been. So it made me think about larger issues. And when I was in college, I came in touch with some people who came from a leftist point of view. And right after college, I got an opportunity to travel through the hinterland in many areas where the Maoist guerrillas were active. And it exposed me to the Indian heartland for the first time. Before that, I had hardly any exposure about how the majority of Indians lived. And it changed my own perception about many, many things. And I came to realize that my own pain, my own suffering was, I mean, though significant, it was just a tiny percentage of what a large number of Indians were going through. It is around that time that I kind of established a contact with the Maoist guerrillas, and I began traveling in those areas. And of course, when you're traveling in those areas, in those times, the security scenario in those areas was lax. You know, it did not have that kind of security which we are witnessing now. So it was relatively easier to travel without invoking any scrutiny from security forces. So I traveled a lot. I really got interested. I got curious about this area. And I started traveling. Of course, in those days, you know, the movement was very nascent. And when one spoke to editors in New Delhi about the fact that this was something which would turn very big, they hardly paid attention to it. But of course, in just a matter of few years, it became what it did. And then it evoked a lot of attention.
And so you were covering it and writing stories about it from that nascent time as it rose to greater significance.
Yes, indeed, David.
Yeah. So the Indian government never sent troops in to try and sort of clear them out. What was the response of the Indian government to this movement, which was sitting on a lot of land?
It was extremely difficult to send troops. You know, this is an extremely difficult area. Till recently, the Indian forces did not even have proper maps of these areas. And like I said, you know, this is an Amazon-like dense jungle where the security forces were dealing with too much. You know, the weather conditions are very harsh. In summer, the temperature rises up to almost 50 degrees. Humidity is terrible. Your biggest enemy in this area is malaria, which is endemic in this area. And then, of course, you do not know the local language. You do not have the kind of motivation which the Maoist guerrillas have. And you do not have the kind of sympathy which the Maoist guerrillas have. So in the initial years, for many, many years, these security forces which New Delhi sent in this area would just land into trap laid by Maoist guerrillas, because they were very meticulous with ambushes. You know, they had military manuals which the Viet Cong used against the U.S. in the 60s in Vietnam.
Oh, right.
They used that, you know, the guerrilla warfare, basics of guerrilla warfare. So the Indian forces could not match that, really. That is why a number of casualties took place. But gradually, of course, the Indian forces also learned from their experience. And like I said, a separate force was raised from the indigenous people, which comprised of local people and, of course, a number of surrendered Maoists who were given a lot of money. So they started making inroads in these areas. But initially, in the initial years, the security for the Indian security forces faced a lot of casualties.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Rahul Pandita, journalist who has covered the Maoist insurgency in India for many years, an insurgency which has now come to an end. Rahul, was it underneath this jungle that a number of very valuable minerals are to be found? Is that what the Maoists were sitting on? A great wealth, a great mineral wealth?
So I, you know, when I try and explain this to an outsider, I have a very simple formula. I say, take a map of India which shows its natural resources, which shows area which has its maximum natural resources. And we're talking about things like iron ore, coal deposits, bauxite, and what is called NTFP or non-timber forest produce. You know, you have things like tamarind, for example, in the Maoist guerrilla zone, which is extremely costly, and it's imported, I believe, to about 70 countries from India. And then you take another map of India, which shows its extremely poverty-affected regions. And then you take another map of India, which shows areas where the Maoist guerrillas are. And if you kind of juxtapose these three maps, you will be surprised to know that these three maps will show you the same area. This is something which the Maoists knew really very well. I remember in 2007, a senior Maoist leader was arrested, and he was a contemporary of Charu Majumdar. And I've read his interrogation reports, and he tells his interrogator at one point in time during in the interrogation, he says, and I'm just quoting him, he says, his name is Sushil Roy, and he says, forest means minerals. Minerals means money. Money means guns. And guns means power. So even the Maoists were very aware of the fact that the territory which they were controlling had immense resources. And in a way, they had promised the indigenous people that these resources, the land and the resources beneath them, they'll fight for the protection of these resources.
And they would belong to the people.
Yes. But I think at some point in time, they lost their plot. You know, they became more obsessed with fighting the state. And of course, they started taking cuts. They became a stakeholder in these natural resources in many ways. And this is what has finally led to their downfall.
You spoke before that the Indian state put a huge investment into opening up these areas and recruiting locals to fight the Maoists. When did that operation begin and how successful has it been?
It began in around 2010 under Mr. Manmohan Singh, and it was something spearheaded by the then Union Home Minister of India, a man called Mr. P. Chidambaram. They started an operation called Operation Green Hunt, which is essentially sending a lot of security forces into this area and, you know, building this road network and mobile networks, which I was talking to you about. But I think this government, which came in 2014, it has essentially focused on the area in the last couple of years. I would say in the post-COVID era, it has started getting a lot of results. But these results are a result of what I was talking about earlier. This strange estrangement between the indigenous people and the Maoist guerrillas, because the more the security forces began, the Indian state began its push in the erstwhile Maoist areas, the Maoist guerrillas became more paranoid and they started killing more and more indigenous people on the suspicion of being police informers.
Right.
So it created a lot of hatred against them in many, many areas, I would say. And coupled with this, you know, development of road networks, mobile networks. Let's imagine if you are a police informer in a village and a Maoist guerrilla, a leader has come to your house, a hamlet, but you have no way of telling the police about this because there is no mobile network. But suddenly you have mobile network now. And it's just a matter of, you know, you just have to dial a number and the police will be there in no time, and the Maoist guerrilla will be killed. So these are the changes that have happened in the last couple of years, especially in the last couple of years, which has led to their downfall.
When did they start surrendering? And I understand that process actually still continuing, but when did they begin to acknowledge that they had lost, and how did they surrender?
I think the real acknowledgement has come in the last 1 year, if I may say so. When suddenly the state forces started getting a lot of results. And a lot of their Central Committee and Politburo members were either killed or they began to surrender. We have, you know, in the last few months, seen a spate of surrenders, including in October of a very, very senior Maoist commander called Sonu, who was among the first squads who entered Dandakaranya in the June of 1980. So most of these surrenders and killings have happened in the last few months. I think what has happened now is that the police have kind of made major inroads as far as intelligence is concerned. I think they have intelligence among the Maoist cadres now, especially in some companies of the Maoists who are responsible for the security of the leaders. I think they've made inroads in those companies among those bodyguards who have given information about the whereabouts of the leaders, and then the state forces have gone and killed those leaders.
Rahul.
So I think it's pretty much, you know, if you really ask me, the moment is pretty much over.
Right. But those surrenders have been accompanied by apologies from the Maoists. Now, what's that about? Who are they apologizing to and for what?
So I think, you know, the apology came from Commander Sonu, who I was talking to you about. He surrendered in October. So I think By this time, it was clear to Sonu that they had failed in achieving their target. So what Sonu does is he addresses a letter to his comrades, and he addresses a letter to the people they were supposed to represent. And he apologizes in that letter, basically saying that, you know, they have strayed from their goals, etc. So that was the crux of that leader. But after that surrender, you know, Sonu's elder brother was also a very senior Maoist commander, a very efficient Maoist commander, if I may say so. He was killed in an encounter in 2011. People like Sonu and Kishenji, you know, they're very difficult to replace because, you know, they came from that commitment and motivation and that ideological training, which is very rare to find among the new Maoist guerrillas. So it created a schism in the Maoist ranks and files, in the sense that, you know, the many overground Maoist sympathizers are now calling him a traitor. But, yes, you know, he's a practical man. He has spent decades and decades inside. In my view, you cannot call him a traitor. He has given his entire youth to the Maoist movement, good or bad, you know, that is debatable, but he's given his youth to something he truly believed in. But he's also a practical man. He has seen the downfall in front of his eyes, and he has just sought it right to surrender in front of the state forces, and that is what he has done.
Rahul, how is this going to change India?
I wish I could answer that, David. Now, you know, for decades, the Indian government, successive Indian government, it's not a question of this government or that government. New Delhi has used insurgency as an excuse for misgovernance, saying that, oh, you know, there are insurgents in this area, there are Maoist guerrillas, we cannot bring in development. So now that the Maoist movement is over, many of us are hoping that now some development will happen in this area. But there are civil rights activists in this country who fear that that development might not take place, and it's just a ruse for you know, these corporates to go and usurp this land and the natural resources beneath it. But I'm hoping that as someone who's a well-wisher of this area and who's a well-wisher of the people in this area, I sincerely hope that some sort of development and some sort of progress happens in this area, because the indigenous people, these poor people, were caught in this war between the Indian state and the Maoist guerrillas. And they need peace, they need progress, they need education, they need basic healthcare, like all the people in the world deserve it.
Rahul, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Rahul Pandita, distinguished journalist in New Delhi, who has been reporting on the Maoist insurgency for many years, and who has just published his first novel, Our Friends in Good Houses, published by HarperCollins, and the notices have been good. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, the uncertain fate of the nation's public pools. Summer's here, and pools all over the country are getting crowded. Australia has 1,300 public pools that clock up hundreds of millions of visits every year. Their chlorine waters have produced generations of young swimmers and swags of Olympic medals. But all is not well with our pools. Many are now over 50 years old. According to Royal Life Saving Australia, hundreds of them face closure in the next decade unless money can be found to carry out major repairs. It's a prospect being studied by Dr. Elizabeth Taylor, senior lecturer in the Department of Architecture at Monash University. She also heads the volunteers who run Elmore Pool near Bendigo in Victoria. Liz, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Hey, where did you learn to swim?
I learned to swim in a few different pools in central Victoria. One would be the Castlemaine Pool, which my grandfather actually constructed, and I was always thinking about it in those terms. And the other one was in Ballarat at the Eureka Stockade swimming pool.
Oh dear, that is a...
That doesn't have the best connotations.
These days it has an ugly ring of George Pell about it, but we will put that entirely
that
to
part
one
aside.
Side.
Yep.
When were the pools built in Australia?
Well,
and
I think
why?
And why? Okay, so we've got a few phases of public pool construction, but I think it's useful to go back right back to the 19th century. And before that time, really most people couldn't swim. And that's true around the world today. Most people, over 55% of adults in the world today, can't swim. So it's not kind of universal that people swim. But late 19th century in Australia, as in a few other countries, there's this sudden interest in swimming for kind of health reasons, for leisure, for kind of public morality. And there was a push to construct the first kind of swimming pools. And the first ones were gender segregated because at that time they hadn't invented swimming costumes really. So men mainly swam in the nude. So there was a kind of transition period where you had men's baths and ladies' baths. But by the kind of 1910s, 1920s, you saw hundreds of these early swimming pools being constructed. In somewhere like Victoria, there were about 300 of those. It was also a push for education, I should say. So swimming for life skills so that you would be able to save yourself and save others. But they were usually at that stage more like lakes. So in Bendigo, for example, the main baths were just a really enormous lake, about three times the size of an Olympic pool today.
They weren't for racing. They were for just swimming.
Yeah. Just fun. A lot of diving as well was going on, and recreation. They were kind of places people would just hang out, and they're often in gardens as well. And they weren't chlorinated. It was just fresh or slash muddy water. You also had, of course, in New South Wales, the pools along the ocean being constructed as a kind of enclosure from the sea. There was a lot of involvement of unemployment relief, so they were built as work for the Dole projects effectively. But most towns and suburbs had to have a pool to teach swimming because it was compulsory at that time. So these were really widespread. But what you see after the Second World War, and I'm thinking particularly about a Victoria here, there was a push to upgrade those kinds of, you know, swimming holes or lakes into Olympic standard pools for racing, because there was the 1956 Olympic Games in Melbourne. There was an aspiration towards, you know, swimming champions. And there was also a new interest in concrete and chlorine and filtration. So again, you had, it was pretty widespread, but about 200 just in Victoria of these Olympic-style pools were constructed in those decades following the Second World War. And it was really just kind of a standard thing you had in all towns, suburbs, was to build these kind of symbols of modernity. They were always blue. They had a lot of concrete. They smelt. People have this intense nostalgia. You were saying before, the nostalgia for the pool is that icy pole, hot concrete, blue chlorine, yes, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's when most of them were built. And of course, some of them went on to be kind of upgraded and progressively expanded in a way. Like the kinds of pools that are getting built now are very different. They tend to be indoors. They have all these other things added on, gyms and cafes and things like that. And the price tag now is pushing like $100 million is some of the latest ones. So they're really serious new infrastructure now, but we also have this legacy of the older Olympic style pools, which many of them were actually funded and built by volunteers. So there might have been war memorials, or they had pledges and things. So they had a real community.
They weren't necessarily councils that were built.
Yeah, there were some that were. So the inner city baths tended to be very much municipal projects, like say the Fitzroy Pool or the North Melbourne Baths, which I've studied as well. But in suburbs and regional areas, usually what would happen is you could apply for a grant from the state government, but they would just match your funding. So you had to come up with about 2/3 of the funding yourself. And it would be things like beauty competitions, so really retro stuff like that, or fishing competitions, and people just donating. And I think that really fed into the sense that these were community assets as well, which made it harder when they started to close. And that's that kind of legacy that I'm studying. Pools like, say, Tugen near Castlemaine, that was built by volunteer labour, mostly donated materials and money with a grant from the state government to supplement that. But it was the sense that it was a community pool. But in the 1990s, like a lot of these volunteer-built and often volunteer-run swimming pools in regional Victoria, they got kind of handed over or taken on by local governments because the compliance issues were becoming more difficult and it was becoming more professionalised industry. And that's when you started to see also pools being closed. And then that kind of compounded it. So people built them or donated them, if not themselves, then their parents or their grandparents. But then they become recast, I suppose, as just too expensive, too hard to keep going.
Are we swimming less as a nation?
I think the serious and sad point to make first is that we're drowning more. So the drowning rate is going up year on year, this over 350 this past year. And that sort of turned around years of bringing the drowning rate down, which was one of the main reasons why swimming and swimming pools, swimming education became so common, was to try and have that safety skill. So that's one point. We're still exposed to the dangers of water, but we're no longer routinely swimming. And another thing to emphasize is just the inequity of it. So for many people, they have, maybe they have their own pool, they have a pool at their private school and a public pool, and they live next to the beach. They're not seeing a decline in swimming skills. It's really driven by increasingly wealth and where you live. And in parts of Melbourne, for example, our growing western suburbs, you have very few aquatic facilities, and you also have a lot of migration from countries without a strong swimming culture. And so it's partly driven by that kind of hollowing out of the local infrastructure, changes in the way people's time is planned. So children often have to be driven to lessons now, and they're increasingly further away and they cost money, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you have inequities in location, and then you've got migration. So we've always had migration, obviously, in Australia. It's a colonial migrant country, but swimming education used to be part of that process, and now it does seem to have become disconnected, and some of the highest drowning rates are for migrants to Australia from places like India and Bangladesh, where there isn't a strong swimming culture, but then you're getting people coming here and really obviously want to visit our beautiful beaches and things, and they don't have the skills there. So I guess the answer is some of us aren't able to swim and not being given the opportunities, and that inequity is driving our drowning rate as well.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Liz Taylor, Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning and Design at Monash University, about Australia's pools. Liz, how do you save a pool that's facing closure?
Well, good question, David. I've spoken to about 30 people who have gotten involved in Save Our Pool campaigns since the 1990s. I think first thing to note is that people really do value pools, and you see that community value come out often when you're faced with losing something. Maybe there's something ironic there about you only notice it when it's going, but genuinely people do value them as community places. And when they come up for closure, and that has happened increasingly since the 1990s in Victoria, as these post-war pools, first of all, that they are not necessarily maintained, and they might have a kind of life cycle, 50 years or so, but it's also about how they're understood. And with council amalgamations, for example, that started to really super drive this idea that those older pools were no longer fit for purpose and were uneconomical and so on. So beginning with, say, Fitzroy Pool, North Melbourne Pool, and a few other urban pools in the 1990s, basically you have to put up a huge fight. And unlike Fitzroy Pool, which is the famous one, because it had celebrities involved, and it only took a few weeks to, you know, they had a protest, they filled the pool, the decision got turned around. Most of the people I've spoken to who advocated to keep older local pools going, they spent years of their life fighting for it. So it's really a colossal amount of volunteer advocacy that goes into sort of making submissions, turning up to protests, and you might not even make it. So it's definitely a long run game. We also have in Victoria, as I am as well, a legacy of pools that are still run by volunteers. So we do, to take the case of Elmore, we do get a lot of assistance now from the City of Greater Bendigo in some of the finances, but essentially the day-to-day management is done by volunteers and has been for about 60, 70 years. And there's a few of those still going. And that kind of relationship just runs on kind of, you know, hard yakka, basically. It's just turning up and mowing the lawns and scrubbing stuff off the pool.
What fails in a pool after 50 years that requires such expensive repair?
Varies a bit by pools and how they were constructed. Often it's a leak, where it's actually not necessarily well understood where the leak is, but it's probably more typical that it's understood as end of life. So you might need, for example, a new filtration system. They don't necessarily meet the contemporary standards. There's also sort of compliance questions around disability access and the design of the pool and so on, all of which are important upgrades to a pool. But when they're sort of put on a 50-year-old pool, what happens is a calculation where the cost to make that pool compliant with the current standards would be, you know, more than the council is willing to pay. So that's often, but yeah, short answer is often leaks. But some of these pools, like the Elmore Pool and a lot of the other post-war pools, they were built by volunteers with like 2 foot thick concrete. So it actually takes a long time for them to leak. It's more this understanding that they're no longer fit for purpose, I think. And there is often a disjuncture. I found that with Teuton, for example, and some other pools where the way a council is, you know, required to think about pools is a much more actuarial assessment of what it might cost to fix it. That value proposition is understood differently by volunteers who then are willing to, you know, you can reline a pool and get another 20 years of life out of it. So it's often kind of subjective what the lifespan
be,
is.
It can be really expensive. I mean, North Sydney is looking at a bill of 100.
Sorry.
Don't laugh. That is so cruel. The Victorian laughter.
That was mirthful laughter. Sorry.
Yes. $122 million they're looking at the moment. Whoa.
Yes. You know, what I think it is, David, is actually that is the perfect example for it. The cost of maintaining, so fixing a few leaks, upgrading the bathrooms, putting in a wet deck, that kind of stuff, that's more day-to-day, you know, it's money, but it's not $100 million. What often happens is that you have an older pool and the understanding is, oh, we don't want to just kind of maintain it or sort of fix it up a bit. We need to make it, you know, state of the art. We need to add on an indoor pool. We need to add on
a gym,
all this kind of stuff. Because that's the understanding, is that you can't just have a pool. You have to have all the other stuff added on. And that's where you get the, initially it was $50 million, now it's $100 million. And we've had ones in Victoria, the Q baths, which were, you know, sort of more just a regular pool, I guess, and then it became an indoor pool. And then a few years ago, it was demolished to make way for an even, you know, bigger, better state-of-the-art pool. It was so big, the roof collapsed. And now that has a bill of about $100 million. So part of my research is maybe pushing back on those, you know, really trophy projects. Maybe it should just be okay to have the North Sydney pool, which was beautiful to begin with, right? Just
yes.
Keep it going and invest in that sort of regular maintenance and required accessibility upgrades without necessarily adding on the $100 million. Because that then, in the case of a lot of the older pools in Victoria, when they build one of these mega centres or Disneyland pools or whatever we call them, which are wonderful in some ways, but the price tag means that the council will then say, well, now we have to close all the other pools because this is where our priorities lie. So that's and also those more expensive pools, you know, it's not like they have a longer lifespan. They actually have a longer sort of higher maintenance costs as well. So things like heating and the roof structure and so on, you're more likely to see a kind of structural failure in 20 years after that.
What about just digging a lake?
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
You know, just putting a river through it and, you know, bit of mud, I know, and you know, probably a bit of disease, but you know, you could have.
You're not the only one that's asked that. I think we've got a bit of a, you know, a split. There's people, and I'm one of them, that are into kind of swimming in all sorts of places. So you've got wild swimming and enthusiasts of people swimming in lakes and rivers and so on, and that's really seen a return to popularity, particularly since our waterways are a lot cleaner than they were in the 1960s and 70s when people really abandoned that kind of swimming, and that's also been reshaping a lot of cities in Europe where they're putting in swimming pools on the river. And when I say
swimming in the Seine.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So that has seen a return, but then you've also got a lot of people who are, you know, very uncomfortable with the idea of swimming at all. And that, you know, so I guess it'd be nice to see a mix of all these kinds of pools. And say Penrith Lakes in Sydney, I think, is a great example of how you can fit in that kind of a return to the pre-Olympic style of pool again, because that's a pretty low cost infrastructure. It's free. It's just fresh water, and it hasn't cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It's also got an equity basis to it. It's in the west of Sydney where there's not as many opportunities. So I think in some cases, it's probably worth revisiting some of those natural swimming pool models because they don't require as much maintenance, and it won't be for everyone, but it also appeals to that kind of, you know, the popularity of wild swimming, as I mentioned, for some.
Liz, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David.
I've been talking to Dr. Elizabeth Taylor, Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning and Design at Monash University, about the culture and the fate of public pools. And that's the show. We're turning over our next to those two wise men, Ian Dunt and Bruce Shapiro, to take a last considered look at the extraordinary political events of 2025 on both sides of the Atlantic. I can't wait.